This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and now an online store with the new Squarespace Commerce feature. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK4.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 92, Carpe Diem, basically. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Colin Higgins. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Scott Bakula's thoughts on a new season of Enterprise, Shatner and the Texas Lottery, Michael Giacchino's sneak peek at the Into Darkness score, Countdown to Darkness number 4, and a good dose of Alice Eve. Then in the feature, we're joined by Matthew Rushing and Charlene Schmidt to discuss the classic TNG episode, The Inner Light. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Colin. It's quite a surprise to see you here with me today. Normally I would say joining me from the other side of the pond is Colin Higgins, but as I'm not in the United States, I'll just say joining me from the other side of the enormous landmass known as Asia is Colin Higgins. How's everything over there in England today, Colin?
It's rather good, apart from the fact that I'm drinking lemonade and you're drinking alcohol due to the time difference.
It is, you know.
Normally, it's the other way around.
It is. I usually drink water during the show because usually for me, it's like 10, 11 a.m. when we record. It's actually after 11 p.m. for me, so I am foregoing my sake and having a glass of brandy as we record the show tonight.
Yes, that's the last two times I've done the Ready Room. I've been the one with the beer.
That's right.
So I suppose what goes around comes around.
A big one, too. What did you have last time? It was like a yard or something you had there, wasn't it?
It was a Steiner glass, which is 2 points, or about half a litre, just over half a litre.
And somehow you made it to the end of the feature without having to leave the show.
Yeah. I did forego the vodka, so that probably helped.
That's pretty good. All right. Well, I'm glad to have you with me doing news. And, you know, the first thing we're going to jump into today is an event that happened at the end of last week, and that was First Contact Day. And, of course, everyone was excited. Twitter was all abuzz. Everyone wishing each other a happy First Contact Day, which, of course, from our perspective, is a holiday that doesn't truly exist yet.
Not yet. But, you know, we're getting closer and closer every year.
We are. Which raises the question I wanted to ask you. We're now 50 years away from First Contact Day, which is, of course, April the 5th, 2063. You know, looking at how things are going, technology, science, North Korea, I mean, what do you think? Are we on course for first contact 50 years from now? What do you think?
I think there's a distinct possibility that we would be able to travel significantly faster than we can now. If you think of the Americans working on the scramjet, which will make it possible to go from New York to Sydney in just under 2 hours, then that would be a leap forward in technology that could convert into space travel. And then obviously once you leave the gravitational pull of the planet, then who knows what we can achieve.
Right. So when we leave the Earth and our space scramjet and the Taplana Hoth is out there and they see us, and then they're going to come down and say hello. Of course in Bozeman.
Yeah.
Because...
and hopefully Stephen Cochran won't shoot.
I hope not. You know, I put this on our Facebook page. I took a still from the movie. It's actually the behind Zefram Cochran scene where he has his hand up and then the Vulcan, you could see him kind of out of focus there. And I asked two questions. I asked people, first, what was your favorite moment from the film First Contact? And second, What would be the first thing that you would ask or tell the Vulcans at the Montana meet and greet? And luckily, most of them were thoughtful. You know, people excited about seeing the aliens. But yeah, there were a few that were kind of like, get off my land, and that kind of comment of that type. And one of them was, he pulls out the gun and shoots him. And I'm not sure if that person had actually seen In a Mirror Darkly from Enterprise, or if that's simply what they would do. It concerned me just a little bit.
Yeah, I would hope it's from the Mirror Darkly, not just something that I do as a person.
But you never know some of the comments that you get.
Well, no, there is this scene in Broken Bow where the bloke, first thing he does when he shoots the Klingon, he shoots him.
Right, yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, he was in his cornfield, you know. He thought he was a vermin.
Well, yeah, there you go. Took a long time to plant that corn.
But, yeah, I don't know. It's, you know, the number of detections of planets and the fact that we're starting to find planets that are closer to Earth size, that are in what we call the Goldilocks zone, the habitable regions around stars. I mean, I've always believed that there has to be other life out there. The question is, can we find it? And how far away is it? And, you know, it's starting to look like planets like Earth probably are plentiful, and that some of them aren't very far away from us. So, you know, 50 years from now, who knows what we'll find. It seems to me a little bit hard to believe that in 2063 we might actually make contact with aliens. But you never know. You never know.
I mean, a lot of people point towards SETI and the fact that SETI still hasn't found anything. But if you ask anyone who's done anything to do with SETI, is they've done a fraction of the possible galaxy. Yeah. So, and we're on the outer edge of the Milky Way.
Yeah.
So, and we're, as a planet, we're 4 billion years old. As a race, we're probably 100,000 years old. So as you go closer and closer to the center of the galaxy, there's going to be older and older planets, so presumably their civilizations would be more advanced, and there's lots of possibilities.
Definitely. You know, that reminds me, there's an episode of Matter Stream that I did with Seth Shostak, who's the senior astronomer at the SETI Institute, and we talked about this, actually, you know, SETI with a little bit of a Star Trek angle, but it's mostly more about SETI, and he has some interesting things to say, so go over to our website and check that out on Matter Stream. Or in iTunes if you haven't heard it. Very interesting. I love Seth. Great guy. And but that's exactly the thing. Yeah, you know, there's so much left to explore. So we'll see. Hopefully we will make, I don't know if they'll be Vulcans, if they'll have pointy ears or not, but hopefully they'll like Ooby Dooby when we do meet them, and we'll all have fun. So yeah. We'll see.
And a lot of bad whisker.
That's right. Well, a little bit beyond that first contact moment, humans built the first Warp 5 ship, the NX-01, and then that, of course, we decided to tell that story in the series Enterprise after, you know, Future Guy came back and told us everything that happened, told the UPN executives, you know, so they could create the show, and Rick Berman and Brandon Braga and all those guys. Well, now it looks like there's the possibility being kicked around, we talked about this a little bit last week, of Netflix bringing Enterprise back for a fifth season. And what's new this week is that Scott Bakula was talking to the LA Times, and he actually commented on this whole idea. So, Colin, what did Scott Bakula himself have to say about the possibility of a reunion?
Well, Scott Bakula says that he talked about this 8 years ago. In fact, he kicked the idea around about doing this type of momentum to keep it going. And the fact that he would love to do the show, but obviously, you know, time and tide has waited for no man, including the captain of the original Enterprise. And now you've got the problem of the fact that some bloke in Germany owns basically the entire Enterprise set.
Right. Well, maybe they could just go film it in that guy's house. That would be cool. It'd be kind of like Full House in space. Maybe he's got like twin girls or...
Yeah, well, this is, I don't know if this applies to a lot of the listeners, but the box set that I've got with all the movies in, it's actually got the Paramount auction when they sold all the stuff off. And this guy is actually on the film, and they showed this guy's warehouse. And you could quite literally, it would be a cosplayer's dream to be inside this warehouse. He's got phaser rifles, he's got the transporter, he's got the bridge. You know, you could literally, all you would need is studio lights and you're good to go.
Maybe that's what they should do.
And Scott Bakula called it a garage, but trust me, if this is someone's garage, he's got a bloody big car.
Maybe they should just head over there. And while they're at it, you know, as I was saying, Netflix, they could, you know, kick off Full House again. You know, Travis, he didn't have much to do on the show. Maybe they could replace Travis with Uncle Jesse. I think there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah. And Travis could also augment his lines, because instead of saying, I've been in space before you go, you could say, I've been in Germany, you know.
Of course, if they shoot in Germany, you know at some point that David Hasselhoff is going to have a cameo on Enterprise.
Oh, God, no. As long as he doesn't wear the red swimming trunks, we'll be all right.
So,
and have super slow motions.
Yeah. Oh, now I'm like getting, I'm picturing David Hasselhoff, and I'm picturing Kit and Carr and Cylons, because, you know, the red light's going on, and that could make quite a series as well. Don't save
it all. Yeah, I'm thinking about it. If you did do that, I'm sure a few people would love to see T'Pol in a red swimsuit.
I bet they would. So, well, let me ask you real quick before we go into the next story. I kind of had my say last week about how I feel about the idea of continuing Enterprise in the first place. Now, of course, like me, you are a big fan of Enterprise, Colin. Do you want to see a fifth season of Enterprise almost 10 years after the show ended?
No. I think if they did it, they would have to jump the 10 years.
Yeah.
And then because you actually got in the very last episode, then you've got the augmented Enterprise bridge, which was based on the Columbia bridge. So you would have to take that in consideration. But to me, is they closed it off. You had Archer doing the speech. You know that Archer becomes president of the Federation. That's all set in stone because of In a Mirror Darkly. So to me, if they're going to bring Star Trek to TV, I'd want to see something new.
Yeah.
And not revisit something that's had the loop closed, so to speak.
Yeah, I feel the same way. You know, we have some followers on Twitter who tweet us all the time trying to get us to help really support Enterprise Season 5. And I just tell them that I kind of feel like it's done. You know, I wanted to have 7 seasons. I was very disappointed that there were only 4. In fact, I was so disappointed that the show was being canceled that at that time, for one of my clients, I was doing this marketing campaign where I was writing this fake newspaper. It was a mystery game, and I would hide clues in articles that I would write on this fake newspaper. And the whole game was about technology and security and such, but I actually put one article in the game that was a Save Enterprise article, because it was right at the time when Enterprise was going to be canceled after the 3rd season. And at that time, I put that into my project because I really wanted Enterprise to not be canceled. And it did come back for a 4th season, and then, of course, we lost it. But yeah, I think at this point, we need to just go in a new direction. You know, the Romulan Wars are being played out in the novels, and that's really what I wanted to see as, you know, maybe like in a 6th season of the show. So I don't know. I think it's time to move on personally.
Yeah, if Braga did want to go back to his little baby, so to speak, I think the only logical point would be to jump the 10 years mm-hmm. and go to the Romulan War.
Yeah.
And then they could do along the lines of DS9, where you've got the war. So you could make it a lot darker. But to me, I'd want to see something new.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to see, you know, although it would be nice if they give it a proper ending.
Yeah, I know. You're talking about, you know, what happened in the final episode, and I was thinking, you know, that was just Riker's kind of holodeck fetish thing going on there, right? His historical reenactment fetish that he has.
Yeah.
So
I mean, you know, there was a saying a few years ago that you never trust a Finn chef.
So that's Riker right.
Riker definitely is not a Finn chef.
That's right. All right. Well, we'll see how this plays out. Personally, I doubt that we will see Enterprise Season 5 on Netflix. I do wish we had gotten 7 seasons of Enterprise. I am a big fan of the show. But, you know, maybe Netflix might be a venue for a future Star Trek series, though, that's not Enterprise, but is something else. You never know.
Yeah.
Who knows? We'll see. All right. Well, let's move on to our next story. So what do we have up next in news, Colin?
Ah, right. We have William Shatner beaming down to Texas, so this will please Matt, to launch the Texas Lottery, which he did on March the 30th. So all of you people in Texas, the man himself beamed down to launch your lottery with the Star Trek theme.
That's right. Yeah, Matt will be very excited that the Shat is in the Tex. And yeah, this I remember doing this story on Hyper Channel, I think, maybe more than a year ago. I think it must have been at the time when they just announced that they were going to do this. Or maybe it was something different. Maybe another state has done a Star Trek-themed lottery. But at any rate, this is a scratch and sniff. Sorry, it's not a scratch and sniff. This is just like a scratch-off, I think, lottery. They've got different cards. They've got one with the original Enterprise 1701. They've got one with Voyager. They've got one with the 1701D. And they've got one with the NX-01. And what I find interesting, as we were just talking about Enterprise, is that on the Texas State Lottery website, if you go to the section for games, and they have scratch-off games, and you go to the Star Trek page, it is the NX-01 that they use as the centerpiece of the artwork.
Yes, which is a very interesting choice.
It is kind of surprising, right? You would think it would probably be a TNG, maybe TOS, or if they were targeting voters of StarTrek.com polls, it would certainly be the Voyager.
Yes, yes, because the Voyager fans are, when it comes to polls and all that, the Voyager fans are the most active.
At least on StarTrek.com.
But what did strike me is the fact that there's no Defiant.
Right, there is no Defiant. I guess I think maybe they're a little bit suspicious of the ablative armor. You know, they're not quite sure what's going on inside that ship. You know, they can't penetrate the ship. They're a little suspicious.
Mm. Of course, if you've got an ablative armor scratch card, you might not be able to scratch anything off.
Yeah, what would you need to use to scratch off ablative armor? That's the question I want to know when it comes to the Texas Lottery.
Yeah. Well, in the case of the NX-01, it'd probably be a Mark 1 photon torpedo.
Right.
But with the Defiance, it would obviously have to be something along the Jem'Hadar lines.
I think so. Yeah, the NX-01 is just like,
yeah,
scratch off with a coin that's in your wallet.
Yeah.
You could use a Japanese 1 yen piece, which has got to be the flimsiest coin I've ever felt in my life. I mean, it's lighter than the old...
Would you have to polarize the coin now to do it?
Yes, I'll issue that command. Travis, polarize the coin. I'm just a pilot, Captain. I can't do that. You had speaking lines.
And obviously, the Constitution Class 1 of Kirk's, you don't actually have to touch it. You just talk it to death and all the things fall off.
That would be perfect. So anyway, this is going on. You can win up to $50,000 instantly. So if you're listening and you are in Texas, definitely go pick this up. Maybe we should get Matt to pick us up some of these cards and send them to us.
Yeah. Well, she'll get Matt to pick some up and not scratch them, because they'll probably be worth more. Because I wouldn't be able to claim anyway, because being in the UK.
So do you...
They'll just have the unscratched versions.
Right. Do you think we could sell, maybe like 20 years from now, could we sell the unscratched versions of these cards for more than $50,000 at Christie's auction?
Well, if you wait 50 years until the Vulcans have landed, then we'll get a small fortune for them.
Oh, they'll just want to trade us for Velcro, probably.
Yeah, but on that point, then we get to meet T'Pol's great-grandmother, so that's not such a bad thing.
That's not too bad. That's not too bad. So anyway, Shatner was there to help kick this off, and in addition to introducing the scratch cards, they were attempting to break the Guinness World Record for the most people dressed as Star Trek characters, which was set over there in your homeland, Colin.
Over here.
Now,
I was there when it happened.
You were there when it happened. Now, how many people were there with you at Destination Star Trek London?
I think the record is 1,063.
Yeah. Now, I think
and
the people...
That's just counting the people in costume. The actual people in the room was probably close to 2,000.
Oh, sure. Yeah, just the people in costume. Now, the people in Texas, they fell a little bit short here, didn't they? Now, in Texas, they like to do everything big, but apparently they didn't quite do this as big as they needed to.
Well, they was up against the Brits, so, you know, they obviously got a bit worried.
Right. So they only had 561 fans who turned up in costume for the scratch-off launch with William Shatner. That's still pretty good, I would say, but it's far short of the goal that they were trying to hit.
Yeah, I think the Star Trek London record is safe until Star Trek Vegas, and then they'll blow it out of water.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. But I don't know. It seems like that 1,000 to 1,200 range kind of seems to be the sweet spot for people who are willing to come in cosplay to the con. Mm. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, with Trek FM... all get dressed up, then, you know, that'll bump it up by 6.
That's what we need to do. All right.
that could be the tipping point. It might be 1,069. And Trek FM make all the difference.
That is the magic number.
And obviously 69 would be appropriate for our lot.
Most certainly would. So, I wanted to ask you also, can you think of anything over there in England that might be launched where a Star Trek actor would be the perfect person to show up to help kick off any sort of contest, any sort of special promotion?
Oh, let's see. Well, I suppose they could have had... There's a space centre in Leicester, which is an interactive exhibition of space travel. A Star Trek actor would have been perfect for that. Marina Sirtis, obviously, being born in London, would have been ideal. But although Marina Sirtis did recently open a caravan show, that's not really Star Trek, unless you're going to fit nacelles on the back of your caravan. But, you know, stranger things have happened.
You could do it. I'd like to see that.
You know, I've seen a dog dressed up as the Enterprise. So.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, here in Japan, what we might do. And I don't know. You know, I was thinking maybe like some sort of... I'd like to see maybe Tuvok and T'Pol come together to kind of merge Vulcan ceremonies with Japanese tea ceremony. Because I think like the two of those things coming together would be...
That's an interesting...
Truly fascinating.
Obviously, if there's a restaurant opening, then Neelix is your man.
We'll get Neelix to cook blowfish. Because, you know, blowfish is very popular in Japan, but it must be prepared very carefully or else it will kill you.
I think that's amazingly poisonous.
It is poisonous, yes. I've actually eaten raw blowfish before. It's not something I would normally do, but this was like...
Wow.
This was 1998, I believe it was, and I was doing a TV show for E! Television Network in the States. So we were doing this... Wild On. They did the series called Wild On. We were doing Wild On Japan. And one place we went, you might have liked this. We went to this prison restaurant in the middle of Tokyo in Roppongi, where it's a prison themed restaurant. You go in and they handcuff you to the person you went in with, and they throw you in a jail cell, and they serve you your food in the jail cell, and the drinks are served in beakers. And instead of napkins, they put a roll of toilet paper on the bars. And if you need the waiter, you have to rake this rod across the bars And then the waiter comes and opens your cell for a moment.
It sounds like an S&M fan's dream night out.
It does.
And actually, the idea of being handcuffed to someone on one evening will probably appeal to Charlene.
Well, I was handcuffed to an actress from Baywatch, so I wasn't complaining very much at the time. But
No, I can't think why you would complain.
I was not complaining about that. But anyway, I think Tuvok and Paul coming over, doing that like Vulcan Japanese tea ceremony would be quite nice. Plus, Tuvok dressed in a kimono was something that I think all Star Trek fans want to see.
Yeah, and when we've seen Spock in his bathrobe, so
that's right.
Tuvok in a kimono would be the next logical step.
So Tuvok is going to rip a little bit off his kimono, wrap it around his head, cover his ears.
Yeah, because they teach that at the Vulcan Science Academy, how to blend into native inhabitants, cover the top of your ears.
That's perfect.
You know, whether with a scarf or with a beanie hat, whichever works.
That's right. So I guess we were talking about the Texas Lottery here. So if you're in Texas, go and check this out. We'll put a link in the show notes on the show page to take you over there. And mainly for people who aren't in Texas to check it out. If you are in Texas, I hope you know where to go and get your scratch cards. Okay, Colin, let's take a quick break from news. And after news, we've got a bunch of Into Darkness related stories to talk about. Before we do that, let's tell everyone about our sponsor, Squarespace. So Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website or a blog or portfolio if you're a designer. And now you can even do an online store with the new commerce feature, which is really awesome. I've been waiting for a feature like this for a long time, and I'm really excited about what they've done with Stripe. But you know, whether you need a large website or a personal blog, or if you're an artist, or if you want to sell stuff, Squarespace really is the place for you to go. And it's 100% drag and drop system. You know, Colin, I've built websites in Dreamweaver for years and other tools even before Dreamweaver was around, going back into the mid-90s. And I threw it all out the window when I found Squarespace, because what I found with Squarespace was that all that time that I was spending managing various files and folders and digging into HTML code, which, you know, I can write by hand, and CSS and all this if I have to. But what I really wanted to do is I wanted to create content, and I wanted to get that content out to people, and I wanted all the tools to just get out of my way. And I wanted to make the site look the way I wanted as a designer, and I wanted to share my content. And Squarespace makes that so incredibly easy to do.
So Squarespace made your life easier.
It made my life a lot easier, indeed. And it's amazing the things that you can do with Squarespace, because it's a template-based system, and a lot of people kind of shy away from that sometimes, especially designers. You know, my peers think I could never use a template-based system. But Squarespace, their templates are professionally designed by real designers. They're beautifully done, and they're great. Well, first of all, they're great just to use right out of the box. You know, if you want a personal blog, go choose one of the many templates that they have, and you're going to have this fantastic looking blog or site to start with. But if you have a vision in place of what you want the site to look like, it's very easy for you to use the tools in Squarespace to tweak that and make it your own. And you do it by using sliders or by choosing some of the 300 built-in fonts. You know, you can just change numbers to adjust the spacing, the width of your site, whether you have a sidebar or not. That's just a toggle switch. It's just so easy, and it's all done in your browser. You know, you can use Firefox or Safari or Chrome, any modern browser, and even photos. You don't even have to manage files and folders. You just drag your photos right into your browser window. Squarespace creates 7 different sizes of the photos and then intelligently uses those throughout the site, depending on the template. So you don't even have to spend your time creating all these multiple versions of your artwork.
So Chris, even people like me who know nothing about programming and anything along them lines, as talented as people like you are, even us noobs, shall we say, can use these to set up a website or a web page or a blog. And because basically I can click and drag. So if I can click and drag and set this up, then anyone can click and drag and click the set of things up like these. And I do like the fact that there's so many choices. So again, someone like me who knows next to nothing about this type of thing can easily manage to set up their own website or web page.
Absolutely. Yeah, you set it up and you'll have people coming to you asking you, did you design this site yourself? And they'll start asking you questions about it, because I actually get this quite often. If people who don't know that that's actually my profession. And they ask me about it because they're so impressed. And sometimes it's stuff. Now, Trek FM is very heavily customized Squarespace. But like my personal blog isn't. My personal blog is Squarespace, and it's pretty much straightforward Squarespace. And I have people ask me about it all the time, and they're very impressed. And so it's so easy for anyone to create that kind of site.
And talking of settings, Squarespace can help you add a store to your website.
The store thing is very cool. I've had to set up stores for clients in the past. You know, having to decide which system we're going to use to process orders. And there's a lot of setup you have to go through there. You know, you have to deal with your bank sometimes. And what Squarespace has done is they've reached an agreement with Stripe. They've integrated that into Squarespace. And it only takes you a few minutes to set up the commerce feature. And you're ready to go. And you can sell physical products. You can sell digital products. You can create coupons. It handles the taxes for you, which is really fantastic. It's just done for you right there in the system.
Yeah. So that's, even if you're not good at maths, it helps you out then.
That's right. That's right. Which... it helps me out because I'm not good at math myself. One other thing I wanted to tell everyone about in this week's show are two new templates and one new feature that have been added to Squarespace just over the past week. The feature first is the calendar feature. And this is quite cool. If you, let's say you have a site and you're managing an organization, maybe you're managing a band, something where you need to get dates out there to people. The new Squarespace Calendars feature, it actually allows you to very easily create an event collection with either a calendar view or a list view. And it's really easy to do. You know, you just drop it in there. It's another block, as you do with Squarespace, the way you build sites by dragging blocks onto your page. You put your events in there, and you can display them as a traditional calendar or a nice ordered view with the date and the event and the information about the event, links to buy tickets, whatever you want to include in there, thumbnail images, URLs. And then your visitors can actually share these events through their social channels. They can add them to their Google calendars. They can add them to iCal. And you can even push that information out via your social media channels using the great media push capabilities that Squarespace offers you. So that's a really cool new feature.
That's very cool.
And the other thing are two new templates. One of them is called Momentum, and one of them is called Adirondack, which sounds like a character from Star Trek, actually, but it's actually the name of a template. And the Adirondack template could be quite useful for a store. And what's really cool about it is it has this huge image as you open it, but as you scroll down, the image will fade away and reveal the rest of your page. It's a really, really cool effect that they have going here. And then it's already set up, you know, with basic pages to help you set up your shipping information, your return policies, your terms and conditions. And this would be a perfect template for you to use with that commerce feature that we talked about. And the other template, Momentum, is a great template for either a blog or a portfolio. They list it as a portfolio template. I'm actually using Momentum now for my personal blog. Fantastic full bleed, which of course is a print term, but we can use it in the browser here as well. Full bleed image for photography on your front page. And then you go in, it has a very beautiful, clean design for your blog, or for you to show off other photography by using the great gallery features of Squarespace. So these are two great new templates and a great new feature for you to try out. And we'd like to invite you to test these out for yourself. Squarespace has a great offer for Trek FM listeners. You can go to squarespace.com/trek and you can use offer code TREK4 to get 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And if you choose the annual plan, you can also get a free custom domain through Squarespace. They'll help you register your custom domain. You know, if you want to have colinhiggins.com, they can take care of that for you. You can hook it up. It's really simple. And the pricing is fantastic.
Well, the pricing is $8 for standard, $16 for unlimited, and $24 for business. 10% off that, folks, if you use the TREK4 code.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's not only for your hosting, it's also for this amazing CMS. So definitely go try it out. 14 days, free trial, no credit card required. You just enter your name and an address, email address, and you get all the features for 14 days. You can try it for free. You can import your existing site from tools like WordPress or Blogger, see what it's going to look like, tweak it, make it your own. And then if you decide to sign up, and I know you will, use offer code TREK4 and get 10% off at squarespace.com/TREK, and you'll be supporting our sponsor and you'll be helping us bring this programming to you every week.
I'm picking a fight with a future scar. Sending down rough spots to smooth so far. You got a chip that's dead approved. Blind spot to hide, better get on.
So, Colin, you know, I've always said, as this trend has been growing of making movies in 3D, when real life becomes 3D, that's when I'm really going to buy into it. And we're getting a little bit closer with Star Trek Into Darkness, which is shot in 3D. And not only that, but finally, thanks to YouTube user AVIndustries13, we were actually able this week to watch the Star Trek Into Darkness international trailer in 3D.
Yes, and I watched it today just before recording, and I've got to admit, it looks very cool.
It did look quite cool. I did the same thing right before we went on the air. I went in and watched it in 3D, and I was pretty impressed. It was quite nice. And, you know, the method for the 3D, I think, is not the method that will be used in the theater. It was kind of the over-under. I don't know the exact terminology for it, but you take the same image and you put it above and below itself. And then when you switch to that mode for 3D, if you have a 3D television and you put on the glasses, then you get 3D. Now, Colin, have you been to an actual 3D movie, a recent 3D movie in the theater?
Yes. Been to see a few 3D movies in the cinema and even IMAX ones as well, because we've got on IMAX.
Oh, man, that would be awesome.
So, and my TV's a 3D TV, yeah. So I've got that advantage as well.
Well, I noticed with recent ones that if you take the glasses off, the picture still looks fairly normal. It's certainly not this above-under thing. It's the movie a little bit out of sync. And so I'm sure that's what...
Yeah, it's a lot blurry.
Yeah, that's what the actual Star Trek Into Darkness 3D movie is. I think that this one was created by this YouTube user. And it worked really well. It worked quite well. But I think that what we're going to see in the theater will be a lot more polished than what you see if you go and you watch this in 3D right now.
Yes, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, this is the thing. I don't know if Matthew has watched this trailer in 3D yet or not. But he's going to be really jealous of us, Colin, because we have both watched Alice Eve in her underwear in 3D.
Yes, twice.
Twice. Colin now knows that if you pause a 3D video on a 3D TV, it still stays crisp in 3D, right?
Yeah. And you don't get no buffering.
So, that's right.
So you can have Alice in your living room, projecting out of your telly in her underwear, which is not a bad thing.
In 3D, it's not. But she's looking at you going like, what? What?
That's probably because she's wondering why I've paused it.
She's right. That's the expression. If you read Alice's face, it says, Colin, why have you paused the trailer right now?
Yeah. It's almost as if it's, what are you doing?
And where's Matthew? That's what
where's Matthew?
That's what she's saying right there. So, but it was nice to see this. I probably will be able to see the movie in 3D, but I probably won't be able to see the movie in 3D until August when the movie is released in Japan. I think I'll be able to
see. I've only got to wait till May the 9th.
I know, it's crazy. And the original release date was in the middle of September, and then they moved it up. So anyway, I think I'll be able to see the movie sooner, but I'll have to go to a military base. And I kind of have a feeling that the military bases probably don't have 3D screens to show movies on. So I'm just guessing here, but I'm thinking probably not. So I probably won't be able to see it in 3D until August when it is released.
Unless they put two screens next to each other.
No, do it like this trailer. Put two screens. Put one screen above the other one. That's how you'll do it.
Yeah, yeah. And then just put your 3D glasses on and it'll look like it's 3D.
Exactly.
Although being a military base full of military personnel who are away from home and loved ones, I should imagine that Alice will get froze a lot.
I have a feeling that might be the case. Yeah. And well, can you blame them? I mean,
and if Zoe redoes the part she did in 2009 film and also gets down to her underwear, then I should imagine that will get froze as well.
Well, if they take a note from the Star Trek ongoing comic series, and they put Uhura in some of the situations that she's been in with Spock in that series, yeah, maybe there will be a lot of freeze framing going on.
Yeah. I just word of advice, Dave Fax, when this does come out on DVD, I wouldn't borrow it off Matt because certain parts will be worn more down than others.
Absolutely. Okay, so more news here. If you want to see this trailer in 3D, we'll put a link in the show notes. Again, it was done by user AVIndustries13 on YouTube, so you can search for that username. Or we'll put a link in the Enhanced Podcast as well, and you can click through, and also we'll have a link on the show page. Other videos that came out this week, Colin, related to the movie, Michael Giacchino posted some clips from the recording of the Star Trek Into Darkness score. And I believe there were four or five of those that TrekNews.net put together on a page for us.
Yeah, and it's really cool to see a behind the scenes, the music coming together and how they put the music together. And in one of the videos, JJ is there as well.
Giving a thumbs up.
So you get you gave him a thumbs up, giving a glimpse. So there's him overseeing what's going on. But I would just like to say that I'm glad Michael's forte is music, because his filming is not JJ standard.
Definitely not. And there were no lens flares in these videos, which JJ must have been very disappointed
about.
Well,
there's that as well, yeah. I mean, when he panned around to JJ, I half expected him to be shining a torch at the camera.
Shaking the iPad, as we've talked about before, right? Yeah. He likes to do it all in camera. You need it to be very organic. But no, I mean, you have a good point about Giacchino, though. I mean, fantastic composer. I'm really loving his scores. I mean, of course, there are the giant, you know, the timeless composer. Spock would call them the giants, right, from the Voyage Home. John Williams, you know, Jerry Goldsmith, these guys. But if I think about...
The giants,
that's right. But if you think about the film composers who have come on the scene and started scoring a lot of movies in succession and I'm really loving their work. I kind of think the last like fresh face that came in that I can think of was when Danny Elfman came in. If you remember back, like Beetlejuice, Batman, all this stuff back in the 80s.
Yes.
When Danny Elfman...
The Batman score was phenomenal.
Phenomenal, right? I know. You know, Danny Elfman, he was the drummer in Oingo Boingo, and you take that over to his film scores and you can completely hear all of the influence, but with an orchestra. And it was brilliant. And I started following all of his scores, film after film. And I'm kind of becoming like that with Giacchino now as well. You know, he did, of course, Star Trek 2009. And he did Up, which had a fantastic score, Pixar's Up, Super 8, John Carter, Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol. I mean, he's becoming, like Elfman was in the late 80s and through the 90s, he's becoming like that composer for our current time. And he's won an Oscar, and he's a really brilliant composer. And I'm really looking forward just to getting the soundtrack to Into Darkness. I was kind of disappointed that in the clips that he showed, as JJ does with what's happening in the film, he didn't give much away, because the clips were pretty much the same music that we're quite familiar with from the closing credits of 2009. He didn't really give much away.
Maybe that's why JJ was there, making sure he didn't give nothing away.
Maybe so, maybe so. But it was beautiful anyway, and it made me reminisce. You know, I played professionally for 7 years and played a lot before that as well. And it really made me miss sitting in the orchestra and performing.
Yeah, but from my point of view, for somebody who hasn't had that type of involvement, it was amazing to see, because you see him setting up. And from my point of view, it was amazing to see what goes in. It's not just a group of people sitting down with in a room,
right,
playing instruments.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the intricate setup of individual microphones. There's the acoustic settings. I mean, they were there. Was it on the one video at 10 o'clock at night, trying to get it all to sound right?
Yeah. There
so
is.
I found that fascinating because I didn't know anything about that.
Yeah, that is one of the cool things about those videos. The first three, I think there are five of them. The first three are that. Kind of the setup, the behind the scenes, you know, what's going into getting it perfect. And then, you know, I don't know, when you watch a movie sometimes, I think you kind of forget that there are about 100 people sitting on a stage performing that music and recording it in a studio setting. But of course, it's an orchestra, so it's a very large, you have to have a stage. And it's cool to see that actually taking place.
Yeah, and I think it makes you appreciate films that depend on music a lot more, like 2001, for argument's sake, which is very heavily influenced by the music. The scenes are very heavily influenced by the music.
Yeah.
So when you see like the Blue Danube being played at the start, when he's traveling to the moon, that gives you a new understanding of how all that came to be.
Definitely so, yeah. So if you guys want to check that out, we'll put links in the show notes again. That's over on treknews.net. They've got all the videos on one page over there. Colin, okay, we've talked about Alice Eve and her underwear probably far more than we should.
How could you not?
I know, we can't help ourselves. What are we supposed to do?
No.
I blame it on JJ. You know, he's the one that approved the cut of the trailer, I'm sure, and... You know, they put her in the trailer like that. What are we supposed to do?
Yeah, I know. But like we said, Matt will be happy.
He will be happy. But in other Alice Eve news, she is going to be taking on the duties of reading the audiobook version of the novelization of Into Darkness. Now, the 2009 novelization was read by Zachary Quinto. So Into Darkness is going to be read by Alice Eve. I don't know yet if she's going to read it in her underwear. I haven't heard... I might need to go check the Audible blog and see if there's any information or behind-the-scenes photos of that. I'm not sure, but...
If she's not reading underwear, I think she should at least wear a kimono.
She might look good in a kimono. I was going to say Western women. Non-Japanese women typically don't look very good in kimonos. But I actually think Alice Eve She might be able to pull it off.
And I'm sure that like, certain people will listen to it, imagining her in the underwear, if not having that freeze frame while they're listening.
I think, yes, freeze framed and imagining that. But Colin, do you listen to audiobooks very often?
I've listened to two audiobooks. I tend to listen to podcasts more.
Yeah.
The two audiobooks I listen to is Leonard Nimoy reading his own autobiography. And the last one I listened to was a guy called Scott Herzog.
I know, yeah.
He does a sci-fi diner podcast.
Yeah.
And he read a book, and that's the only two I've ever listened to.
Oh, that's it. Okay, well, here are two books you need to go listen to. All the listeners, if you haven't listened to these two books, you have to go listen to them. William Shatner, Star Trek Memories, Star Trek Movie Memories. Two separate books. The first one is about the TV series. Second one is about the films. They're read by William Shatner. Go right now, go to Audible or iTunes, get them, listen to them. You will be very glad that you did. They're brilliant. I love audiobooks. I've been listening to audiobooks since like 2000. And so what is that, 13 years now? I'm kind of ahead of the curve on these things, I think.
Yeah. He was in at the start by the sound of it.
Yeah. Well, I was also buying ebooks back in 2000, which was definitely at the start of it. But
yeah.
But I love audiobooks.
Was that on a 4-foot by 4-foot reading tablet?
It was not, actually. It was on this terrible device made by Franklin, who, maybe you know, they used to make electronic dictionaries. And they made this thing called the eBookman. And it was a terrible device. It was before e-ink was around, and it wasn't backlit, and it used AAA batteries, and they lasted like 45 minutes. And my commute to work was 2 hours and 15 minutes each direction. And so I had to actually carry like 3 sets of rechargeable batteries with me, because I would actually have to change the batteries during the commute because the batteries would run out. But
wow.
But it was better than...
I'd have been all right. My commute is about 40 minutes, so I'd have been there just as the battery was running out.
It would have been perfect for you, but it was better than carrying giant books in my backpack on the train. So that's what I used to do. But yeah, I love audiobooks. And so I'm definitely going to be picking up this one of Alice Eve when it comes out on May 21st, a little bit after the movie. The novelization, which is being written by Alan Dean Foster, who also wrote the novelization to the 2009 movie, and he also wrote novelizations for Star Wars and the first three Alien films, as well as Alienation, The Chronicles of Riddick. So he's very well seasoned in writing novelizations of films. I thought this was going to come out originally.
I've read the Alien books.
Have you read those? Yeah. So
I've read the Alien books, yeah.
It's always fun because novelizations get to fill in a little bit of detail that doesn't necessarily make it into the final cut of the movie. And originally, I had heard that this was going to be released before the movie. And I was thinking, this was when JJ was building a wall around the set, if you remember that, so that people couldn't see what was going on. Inside the set.
Yeah, the cargo containers.
Yeah, the cargo containers. And I was thinking, if the book's going to come out before the movie, what's the point? But as it turns out, it's going to be released the week after on May 21st. It's the list price on the paperback is $16. The audio edition is $29.99, so $30. But the Amazon list price on the paperback is currently $12.65. And on the audio version read by Alice Eve, currently $20.24 on Amazon if you want the CD, or Audible, which is owned by Amazon, if you want the digital download. And it's going to be unabridged, which is wonderful. I love unabridged books. And it's going to run 8 hours and 30 minutes. So lots and lots of Alice Eve to fill your ear canals coming your way. And if you get the CD edition, it's going to be 7 discs.
Wow.
So Colin, you've read 2 audiobooks. Are you going to pick up Alice Eve Reading Into Darkness?
Well, how can you say no to having Alice Eve in your earphones?
I don't think you can. I think it's
No.
It's actually not allowed, so...
8 hours, 30 minutes and all, that'll take me... that'll get me 4 days of travelling to and from work. So that's quite work. That works out quite nice.
Well, exactly. That is why audiobooks are perfect. Okay, so enough about Alice Eve. This is becoming the Alice Eve show. enough about Alice Eve here.
All I want to know is, does the cover of the book come with Alice Eve in her underwear?
That's going to be the...
that'll be good on my iPad while I'm listening to it.
That's going to be the special edition cover, if you get it. You know, like on comics...
Oh, is that the special edition?
On comics, they have the regular cover, they have the comic shop, the special covers.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be like that.
Oh, wow. I'll get the enhanced version then.
Oh, the enhanced version is something altogether different.
Alice Eve and Frida.
Exactly. That's what it is. Speaking of comics, let's wrap up our news segment by just talking about Countdown to Darkness number 4, which is going to be released this week. It's going to be out, as you listen to this podcast, it's going to be out tomorrow on Wednesday. Now, Colin, we have both had an opportunity already to read Countdown to Darkness number 4, so we know how it ends and how it sets up the movie. And the best way to describe this, it's like golf. This comic has taken the movie and it's put it on the tee, and we're ready to tee off.
Yes, most definitely. And after reading this, I'm on serious countdown now for this film. It's definitely got me salivating.
It's a really good setup. It's a really good setup. You know, reading the first 3 issues of this, you were still kind of wondering, where are things going? You know, we've speculated on whether certain characters would appear in the film. And we've speculated on, why is there a Klingon on the cover of number 4? Why do we know from information that has come out that the Klingons will be in the movie? You know, we don't know what they're going to do. We do know from the trailers that part of the action of the movie does take place on Kronos. And after reading this comic, yeah, everything is a whole lot clearer now. We do know what's going on in the film. We do have the setup for the film now. And now I'm just waiting and hoping that I can get to a base to see the film in May, and I don't have to wait until August to find out, you know, what happens next.
Yeah, it's a wonderful setup, and hats off to the writers, because they've clearly researched TOS.
Yeah.
Because this ticks a lot of boxes that you wouldn't know unless you had done that research, without spoiling.
Right, right. Yeah, we're not going to give you spoilers.
Obviously, we can't give anything away. Yeah, we can't spoil anything, but they have done the homework. That's all. You can say that without spoiling anything, but the writers have really done the homework.
They have, yeah. Yeah, we won't spoil anything here on the Ready Room. If you want spoilers, we'll take care of you on Literary Treks. Matthew and I will take care of you over there next week. I think it's a good point, Colin, that, you know, a lot of the fans think that JJ and the writers don't care about Star Trek, and they don't care about the original series, and they don't know Star Trek. But I don't know. I mean, if you read this stuff, they do know the original series, because they are mining little things here and there all through the Star Trek ongoing series, as well as the Countdown to Darkness series, that I think shows that they do know exactly what they're talking about. And they want to chart their own course in the movies, yes, but they're certainly dropping in little things for the long time Trekkies and us all.
Yeah. They've done a good balance. There's stuff in here for the new fans who got hooked in by the new movie. And there's also stuff in here for people like me and you who've been watching this for an awfully long time. So yeah, it ticks both boxes.
Thank you.
Every once in a while, Star Trek hits upon a story that's just great science fiction, even if you take the Star Trek elements out of it. And they did that in the fifth season story, The Inner Light, penned by Morgan Gendel, in which the Enterprise encounters a space probe and Picard proceeds to live out an entire lifetime in the span of 25 minutes. Today we're going to talk about this fan favorite, and to help us do that, we have with us, from To the Journey, and also our managing editor, Mistress Charlene Schmidt. Hello, Char.
Hello. To the Journey!
To the Journey!
To the Journey!
Very good.
And we have with us my co-host from Literary Treks and the Orb, Mr. Matthew Rushing. Hello, Matthew.
Howdy, folks.
We have quite an international show going today, right? We've got you down in Texas, Matthew. Char, we've got you up in some place called North Dakota. Do people really live there?
You betcha.
And of course, Colin, we've got you over there in England, and I'm in Japan, so we are all over the place. We really are everywhere.
Like Jeffrey Combs.
We are everywhere.
Yeah. Well, even Jeffrey Combs doesn't operate in 5 time zones.
Ooh, that's a challenge for the Combs. I think he should answer that one.
I think so.
So, Matthew, you picked the episode today, so why don't you kick us off with The Inner Light?
Well, Chris, I picked this episode, and I know that it's a fan favorite, and I know so many people just love this episode, but I do too. Honestly, it's my favorite Next Generation episode, and really just because of the character development for Picard, really exploring his character in a lot of depth, and doing it in, I think, a really unique way. A lot of techno babble in this episode when you get to the Enterprise scenes, and yet at the same time, what you really are drawn to is and immersed in is this story that is going on in Picard's head. And it's fantastic from production to music to just design. Everything about this episode, honestly, to me, is pretty much perfect. This is TNG hitting on every single cylinder and then some.
Yeah, I agree. It is about as seamless as you get. This is TNG in its prime. And what I find so interesting about this episode is that it had a lot of elements that could have made it a very mediocre episode. You've got the probe of the week. It starts off with Picard. Where am I? What is this place? What's going on? Sometimes that would just be him kind of combating the aliens, figuring out why they've taken him prisoner, and then finding a way out. Or the Enterprise finds a way to get him out. Yada, yada, yada. We've done those stories before. It's the twist that's really brings this story to a different level.
Well, the twist is one, too, that it gets you the first time you watch it. After you know what's going to happen, you still really enjoy the episode, but you know at the end what the probe was and Picard's role in this civilization. The very first time you watch this, it is a little bit surprising at the end when you find out. I mean, you know that he's been pulled in, of course, because it's Patrick Stewart, but the purpose of pulling him in is something that you don't really get until the very end of the episode. And it is a very effective twist.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Well, I think that you just hit on something that's really important, Chris. The rewatchability of this episode, because of how well it's done, because of how well it's acted, I think that all of the guest stars on here are just play their parts to perfection, you know, whether it's the woman who's playing his wife, the people who end up playing his children. One of them obviously is Patrick Stewart's own son. All of these things work together so well, and I think really the overarching thematic elements of this episode as well resonate, and they're timeless. And I think that that's one of those things that, you know, classic Star Trek episodes, they let you rewatch them over and over again because they're tapping into something that's primordial when it comes to us humans and what we're striving for, what we desire, what really makes us tick. And they really get that in this episode with Picard and his just lifelong desire to have a family. And that it's something that's always been there, always underneath the surface, and yet he has buried it very deep. And so that by the time this episode comes around, I mean, we've had him with his confrontation with the Borg, then we had him with family, and then we get him here. And it really comes to fruition in a lot of ways. Picard getting to live out a lifetime where he has everything that he's denied himself in our prime timeline.
I don't think it's so much a denial as a choice, because he chose to walk a career path to be a Starfleet captain, and there has to be certain sacrifices that you also get the sacrifices mirrored in Riker, who gave up Deanna to pursue command. So I don't think it's so much a fact that he knew he couldn't have children. I think it was a conscious choice that in order to get to be a captain of a starship, you have to make certain sacrifices along the way, like he did, like Riker did, like Kirk did. I think the exception to the rule is Sisko, who manages to like juggle the both, but then that's basically because he's on a space station as opposed to a starship that's hurtling across the heavens. So I don't think it's that, but it is an interesting that, you know, you mentioned the acting level, and there's little nuances in this. It's like when Patrick Stewart's sitting on the step and he mentions the nursery, and he does it in such a, it's like he's saying it under his breath. And it's that tiny nuances, and the level of acting in this episode is phenomenal. And it's a chance for Patrick Stewart to really show his acting chops.
Well, and it reminds me what you just said, Colin, of what Scotty says to Kirk in Generations. You know, when did Sulu have time to make a family? And he says to Kirk, well, it's like you always say, sir, if it's important, you make the time. And I think, honestly, the reason that Picard, and even sometimes Kirk, but more Picard, doesn't choose family, he chooses Starfleet, is that he's actually frightened of what it would be to have a family. I think it's his fear, a lot of ways, that keeps him from actually having a family. Again, you look later on in the novels, and you see that what's driven Picard to say no to that for so long has really been this fear that he has about trying to have both, and that it's a struggle.
I don't think it's fair. I genuinely don't think it's fair. I mean,
I think the novels aside, Colin,
because the novels aren't commissioned, aren't considered canon. I personally think it's a career choice. I don't think it's fair, because he actually says, in Generations that he didn't feel the need to have children because his brother did.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then he goes to regret that decision that he made because he loses his brother and his nephew. Mm. And then all of a sudden, it's kind of up to him. So he's made that choice thus far at that point to not have a family, and he says in Generations there will be no more Picards, but I really think in the novels he goes back on that. But yeah.
And there's also the line Kirk says in the movies where he says, people like us don't have families. And then later at the end of the same film he says, I had a brother once, I lost him, I found him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there is the thing with Starfleet captains that they have to give a lot up.
But I think that, I guess I'm drawing from specifically to, again, Generations, where Picard goes into the Nexus and it draws out your deepest desires. And what is Picard's deepest desire? It's to have a family.
To have a Christmas tree.
Well, yeah. He just really misses Christmas. He doesn't miss the Christ or anything like that. He just misses the Christmas tree.
They don't celebrate much on the Enterprise.
No.
The thing
it's not
is,
the same.
I think that there is this latent desire in Picard to have a family, but he's made a decision, like Colin said, not to have a family because he's a Starfleet captain. He's in command of a starship, and it's really hard to split your time and split your duties between work and family, and especially when you might be sending that family into danger and you might not be able to protect the family. And like in the case of Beverly, obviously there's something there between them, but she's also an officer under his command, and he could.
That's because he's Wesley's dad.
That's the theory, right?
I know. That is the rumor.
We talked about that. But he might have to, you know, send her on a mission that results in her death. And it's, I think, when we talk about fear, maybe there's some fear of putting himself in that position where he might have to make those types of choices. So in cases like here in this episode, in the Nexus, cases where we see him in a family situation, we can see that he would be good as a father. He would be good in a family. But it's just a decision that he's made not to have that family. And then he does come to regret that decision when he realizes that Renee is gone, and so there are no more Picards to carry on the family name. But I don't think it's fear of being a father or fear of having a family per se. It's just within the circumstances. It's a choice that is the choice that he made, is how I've always read it.
You've also got the episode in TNG where the Ferengi trick him into thinking he has a son.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a reflection of what he would be like if he did have a child, because of his relationship that he tries to build with the person he perceives as his son. Mm-hmm. And even when he later finds out that it's not his son, he still offers to stay in touch with him.
Yeah, and that's an unusual situation, because in that case, the son is already grown. It's, you know, it's different than having a baby and raising children, as Kamen does in The Inner Light with his two children.
Yeah, because you've got the emotional attachment.
Yeah.
And I can see what you guys are saying, and I think one of the things that really hit me about this episode watching it this time was when Picard tells his wife and he says, "I didn't imagine before that I needed children to make my life complete, and now I can't imagine my life without them." And you see Picard in this episode make that transition where, you know, for 5 years, he's still really living that life of a starship captain, where he's very alone. He's very solitary. Even though he's married, his wife is very patient with him, very loving towards him and giving him that time. And yet he has to make that turn, actually, to decide that he's going to try something really different and something new. And this is one of those frontiers that just Picard never crosses, at least in the show or the movie. And he never allows himself to cross. And you're right, Colin, he does make a choice to say no to it. But I think that there might be just some underlying psychological issues that Picard has that he just doesn't maybe want to deal with. Do I put these people in harm's way? Any of those kind of things. And that's a good fear to have as a starship captain, but I see Picard as being very stoic and he's not as human as he can be if he has a family, because he's cutting himself off from a part of himself, and he's denying a part of his nature by not allowing himself to experience this. And that was what I loved about this episode, is Picard gets that opportunity, at least here, to lower that guard and see what that's like to have a family. And we don't really get to see it play out later on in the series, because they don't really touch on this too much, except for in Lessons. And it's unfortunate that Picard doesn't struggle with this more, or have some kind of other places to try in relationships. But
yeah, well, I think that's the nature of The Next Generation, that it was very much...
It's true.
A series of standalone episodes. I think, you know, as you're saying that, I was just picturing what might be going on in the ship. And I think the problem with Picard and Beverly, we didn't get to see it on camera, is there was actually a monkey on the crew of the Enterprise D. And every time Picard and Beverly got close, the monkey would show up.
That monkey is everywhere.
Ugh. Isn't the
first
monkey?
He was on the D, then he got onto Voyager, he was on New Earth. Yeah. I mean, he's like Jeffrey Combs. He's everywhere.
He is everywhere.
God, the next thing you're going to tell me, he was on Bosom Buddies.
Do you think the monkey and Jeffrey Combs had a fight scene then?
Oh, without a doubt. Well, but which one was the Andorian?
Yeah. I think that that's what was happening, is that Picard, not only dealing with the monkey issue, but he's always breaking up Andorian fight scenes in 10 forward, because those
that's
guys just Guinan every 5 minutes is having to call Picard. The Andorians are at it again.
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
So maybe if the monkey had not been around, we would have seen Picard and Beverly get close and maybe hook up on the series. Luckily, Worf didn't try to date Beverly. He had his eyes
Thank
on
goodness.
Troy instead.
Did he try to date the monkey?
Wow.
I don't think...
God, I hope
I think
not.
Monkeys are too weak.
With the hairdo that Worf had in this episode, the monkey was like, uh-uh. Not dating no girly man.
You talk about the hair... Worf's hair in this episode. in HD, gosh, I don't know. There's this close up of Worf. Now, it's not, I don't know if bad's the right word. It's just like, Worf looks like he's had a rough day. He woke up, he had to run up to the bridge. Maybe he's a little nervous about being there.
Maybe he got woken up a little early, you know, like when you just don't get enough sleep, you have that off day.
Yeah.
Maybe
he'd been busy with Deanna, because you don't see Deanna in any episodes. So maybe Worf would come fresh from wearing Deanna right, hence the ruffled hair, and hence why you don't see
Deanna.
It's a little early
for that in the series. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
I don't want to think about that.
So you're saying that the Deanna thing had been going on for a lot longer than we knew about it?
For two years?
Yeah, two just years behind the scenes. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, if you notice the point from where Worf's hair start gets like unruly, shall we say, that's when it started.
That's when it started.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting theory.
And it's also around about the time when you start seeing Deanna less and less, so, you know.
Because she's in sick bay getting her injuries healed.
Well, yeah, you know, without Julian there to constantly heal him like he does with Jadzia, then... And you don't want to go to Beverly to get healed, because basically she'll genocide you.
Well, no, actually, I think Nurse Ogawa is giving her the treatments, whereas Deanna and Beverly are gossiping.
Yeah.
So, what was it last night? Why the third broken arm in a week?
Let's talk about one of the central topics of what's going on in the planet, because we kind of need this to play into a little bit more of the discussion about what Picard/Kamen does over the course of this lifetime.
Yeah. Well, he does a deal with Jabba the Hutt. Oh, Judah. Buy some atmospheric converters to keep Tatooine going.
Right, because of the climate change problem. And
yeah,
still, after all these years, this episode is very timely in the discussion of the climate change, because you have Kamen and Bataille, who are both trying to do something about this problem on this planet of the climate. And then you've got the administrator, who is pretty much playing the role of a lot of people these days, which is, oh, it's no big deal. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, well, the water level's not been quite what we need, but, you know, it's all right.
No big deal.
We don't need any of those atmospheric converter thingamajiggers. We'll be fine. And
too much work.
You know,
it'll correct itself, right?
Sure. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
future generations are going to figure this out. We don't need to worry about it.
Just a normal thing. So this is a good discussion here. And of course, it gives Kamen, apart from the family side, which we just discussed, it gives Kamen a goal to work towards through his life. And I think that ties in well to Picard's determined spirit, the way Picard is always very focused and determined, very dedicated as a starship captain. And here, as a family man, a father, and a member of this society and this community, and he wants to learn, and he wants to solve the puzzle, and he wants to try to make things better for not only for his children, but for the whole community. And what I found interesting is that Picard, when he first arrives, he still seems very aware of who he is, and that he's on some other planet. He's not supposed to be there. He's asking a lot of questions, and it's never really said for sure in the episode, but I take it that this planet Catan doesn't have space travel. You know, they have not explored beyond, you know, just the orbit of their planet is kind of what I feel like. Maybe
yeah.
Just
a
little
bit. At the end, they mentioned that Picard suggests some way of saving people while getting them off planet. And the administrator just says, we've just started experimenting with rockets.
Okay,
right,
yeah,
they were
yeah.
So, just so beginning to launch missiles, as he says it.
Yeah.
But you get that all through, you get that feeling all through the episode anyway. And at the beginning, when he's asking, you know, what planet is this? And he says, not a Federation planet. But then he eases into it, and he kind of loses his identity as Picard. And by the end, he really is Kamen. And I don't think he's really thinking anymore about getting back to the Enterprise. But through all of that, the same characteristics that make Picard who Picard is are transferred over to Kamen, and they drive Kamen as well all the way through.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just about to argue to you on that point, saying as much as Picard does live the life of this other person, he's still Picard. He might not be looking for the Enterprise anymore, but yes, his characteristics translated to Kamen. Right. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
It's very much like Janeway when she has her identity stolen in Voyager. She's still Janeway.
Yeah, I kept...
It's very much like that.
Kept waiting for him when he was talking to the administrator to be like, well, I saw this movie called Star Wars, and they had these atmospheric condensers on a desert planet called Tatooine. There were some droids. Those are like robots. But I think it's a good idea.
That explains why later on we see the droids.
Yeah, R2-D2, C-3PO.
Square.
Yeah, which is weird because Picard goes, hey, there are those droids we've been looking for. But I think that that's one of the things that makes this really an interesting character study is that Picard doesn't change. He just allows himself to accept his circumstances and accept the way of life that he's denied himself on the Enterprise. And I think that that's what makes this episode so fascinating is really he's still the same man who's committed to understanding the truth of his situation. And for him, the truth of the situation is this planet is dying. It doesn't seem like they're really sophisticated enough to understand that their planet is dying because their sun is changing. There isn't a lot of discussion of their scientific involvement or progress other than the rockets at the end. And so they don't know what's causing their climate to change and what's causing their planet to slowly die. But what I thought was most interesting is that on the other side, Picard's determined spirit, as you called it, Chris, really drives then his goal for his family, his children, those around him to live most of life that they can while they can, and not to deny themselves things like family and friendship and relationship, because those are the things that are important. Those are the things that will those are the only things that will matter. You know, it's not really accomplishment or, you know, whether you do, it's who you had a relationship with. And I think, you know, we take that lesson back. That's a hugely important lesson for us. It's what we leave behind is not, you know, our accomplishments, but it's usually the people and that we've had the most impact on, our families, our friends, the relationships we've had.
Right. Yeah. One of the biggest messages is just live in the moment. Carpe diem, basically.
Yeah, that's what Kamen tells his daughter, Maribor, when she's older. She's probably in her 20s at that point. And yeah, he tells her to seize the moment and live in the here and now. And it'll never come again. Which again echoes, there are a lot of echoes here from The Inner Light in Generations. And, you know, I think we're always kind of looking ahead all the time. And sometimes we forget to enjoy the moment, because there's always something that's due tomorrow or due next week, and you've got to be somewhere at 5, and it's just always, life's like this rush, and it just pushes you through, and you have to remember to stop and enjoy what's happening right now, whether it's good or bad. I mean, it's happening right now, and that's life, and that is what Kamen, I think, is trying to teach his children here as well, especially knowing that they have limited time. You know, he knows that his children are not going to live to, well, his, you know, Maribor does live to be rather old, but probably none of them are going to live their full lifespan on this planet.
Right. He does say that his grandson's not going to have the long, fulfilling life that he hoped that he would have.
Definitely not, yeah.
But it's interesting to know, like, how the Picard core started to sign, because Picard, the captain, is the explorer, and Kamen explores the planet. Mm-hmm. Like, he goes for the long walks in the mountains and stuff like that. So he's still the explorer, and he's still the scientist, because he builds the telescope, he develops the sun cream. So there's still that scientist in him as well. So it's interesting how they kept the core of the person, even in a different situation. So right. I thought that was nicely done as well. And he's still a diplomat.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he's working with the guy on the council and is trying to make his voice heard, working within the system instead of fighting it.
Unfortunately, though, he never called a staff meeting.
No. Staff meeting.
They should have had a staff meeting in the town square.
They didn't have a conference room, I don't think. That was the problem.
Yeah, but there's no observation lounge.
They could have had a council meeting.
They can meet around the tree in the center.
Yeah, all hold hands.
That's true.
Sing kumbaya. He could teach him Frere Jacques.
Yeah.
I mean, they actually say that he's on the council, so they could have had a council meeting.
Council meeting?
I like that, around the tree.
Yeah.
The fact that he played Frere Jacques, I think, was nice because not only because that's Picard, and you remember in Disaster, that's what he has the kids sing in the Turbo Lift as well. But the lines of the song, you know, are you dreaming, is a question I think Picard, early on anyway, had to ask himself if he's dreaming. He wakes up and he finds himself in this new life. And it was a nice touch.
Well, and that's one of those things that I think is so interesting. Here is that it's that at that moment he decides, I'm going to stop living as if this is a dream and I'm going to face this as if it's reality, because that's the moment he accepts, okay, I'm a married man, I have responsibilities to my wife. He obviously has grown to love her as well, and yet he sees the utter selfishness of his life of pretending that he's in some ways not been married, just like he's still living the life of a solitary captain. So this is the moment where he stops living the dream and begins living in reality. And I think that's really beautiful moment.
Took 5 years.
Yeah. And I think that that's one of the things that we as well get stuck in. You know, we could get so wrapped up in living for our dreams that we forget to live the life that's just around us, you know? You know, John Lennon said, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. And if we get lost in our plans, we might lose what's right in front of us. You know, I might lose that relationship with a friend or with a significant other or something because I'm so worried about something else that in the end may or may not actually be important.
And I think these first 5 years that Picard as Kamen was living, he's not fully invested in this new life yet. He's trying to return to the old one while maybe dabbling a little bit in this new one, trying to become familiar with it. And then this scene we're talking about where he says, no, Eileen, you were right. I've been selfish. And that's a huge turning point for him. Major turning point. Yeah. He realizes this is my life now.
Yeah. I think it's remarkable in the fact that a woman actually waited 5 years for a man to make a decision.
Well, and, but I think that
she's very patient.
I was going to say, I think that watching this again, I was really struck by the fact that this is a beautiful picture of a real marriage, because there are plenty of times in real marriages where you end up waiting for somebody for a long time. And like she says, you haven't been a terrible man. You've been loving. You've been kind. You have never hurt me. You know, you've just been distant. And she patiently waits, but there gets to be a point where she has to confront and say, I need something back from you. And really, it's a great picture of what sacrificial love and marriage is all about. And I think that this is one of those times where in Star Trek, where you really get a beautiful picture of what that's like. And that's really I applaud true. Them for putting this on screen, because you don't see this very often.
Because it takes a story like this in Star Trek to explore that issue, because we don't have those relationships between crew members. So it has to either be between guest characters in a certain episode, which doesn't really have the impact, or it has to be a situation like this where somehow you have put a lead character into that relationship. You know, the only other case where we get it, as we've talked about often, is between Miles and Keiko, probably.
Right.
You have to mention Keiko, do you?
Well, yeah, I was going to say the only place you really get those kind of deep, familiar relationships in general is just when they explore them on Deep Space Nine.
Right, because they can, because the story is on the station. And they have time to explore that home life.
But this is a story that I do come back to, which is unusual in TNG, because, you know, that's normally DS9's forte.
Yeah.
Yeah, very true. One thing I love about this episode is that at the end of it, it's not the reset button, where they could have had Picard forget all about this, or they could have just put it behind him and never brought it up again. He is deeply, profoundly affected by this experience. It does not get lost on him, and we do see him playing the flute again, for instance.
Yeah, I think it's a case where, well, a couple of things. One, as I mentioned in my opening, this is one of those Star Trek stories that works without the Star Trek elements. You could strip all the Star Trek out of this and just write this as a straight SF novel.
Yeah.
And it would work beautifully. And I think that's one reason why you don't get a reset button at the end. Because if it were truly just a Star Trek episode, we would want to move in, especially on The Next Generation, we would want to move to the next week with our characters clean as they were the week before, so we could tell you another self-contained story. So this is the good science fiction in here, that it does not contain that reset button. I think the other thing is the idea of losing your identity. We've been talking about getting caught up in plans, getting caught up in things other than what's happening at the moment. And as things go on, you know, I mean, obviously people change, but things can happen either by choice or by circumstances beyond your control, and you can start to lose yourself and lose your identity. And I think that happens to Picard here. And early on, he's trying to solve the problem to get himself back to the Enterprise. Then he becomes comfortable with his identity as Kamen. He still realizes that he was Picard, now he's Kamen, but he's coming to terms, like we've discussed, with the family. But by the end, I think he has just about completely lost his identity as Picard. He's just Kamen, and he's right at that edge where he's going to completely lose his old identity. And then he wakes up on the bridge, and he says, "This is the Enterprise. I'm Jean-Luc Picard." He snaps out of it, and it takes a moment, and he realizes who he is, who he's not Kamen, he is Jean-Luc Picard. It's like right on the edge of that. And so by retaining the memories as well, I do think this has a profound impact on him moving forward, because he realizes how you can come to that point where you almost become someone else and you almost lose your identity of who you were. And you can feel that actually when he's playing the flute and looking out of the windows at the end of the episode. You can really feel, I think, his internal emotions just through his posture, just through his expressions and as he plays.
This is also the second time he's had his identity stolen from him, because the Borg took it.
Right.
Right.
True.
And you also get a similar in the Borg. He's the final scene in the Borg. He's looking at the ready room window.
Yeah.
Contemplating what's happened to him. So, you know, Picard's really been through the ringer. Although we see the symbology and everything in this episode, to all intents and purposes, this was a life that was forced on him. It wasn't one he chose. He didn't choose to go through this. It's like he didn't choose to be Locutus. So that's both times that someone has forced him to be something he's not. And he's dealt with it both times, and both times it's the symbology of he's there on his own at the end, staring out the window, contemplating what could have been. You know, and when you also think what happens to him after this, where he gets tortured, and he's got all when I come back to this, when he falls in love and he realizes he could have a life with a woman who's got a roll up piano. But, you know, each to their own. But it also shows his depth of character, because he can overcome these adversities and he can carry on being the captain.
And this is what fuels, as Matthew's talked about, how Picard changes once we get into the novels and the post-television Star Trek world, where they actually have given the authors kind of free reign to develop the characters further. It's this depth, it's all these events in his life and this depth of his character, which doesn't really come through on the screen even after this, because of the nature of The Next Generation and the storytelling method of the Next Generation, but it's all there, and that's what they've really been mining and developing. And we get to see it a little bit in the movies, but then it does take off.
Well, yeah.
You go to First Contact, and which is set way after The Best of Both Worlds, and he's still haunted by what the Borg did to him.
Mm-hmm.
That's years down the line. Mm-hmm. So there's no way that this is just going to be cast to the back of the memory banks.
I think we were talking about it a little bit in the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
But I think this is one of the things that I wish the Next Generation had just done a little bit more. Is they do really set up great character development, and then they're willing to just forget about it. And it is too bad because, like you said, Colin, you know, you can pick up on that great character development in First Contact because you know it would be there. You know, a man who has been through what he was with the Borg would have a detrimental effect on his psyche. I mean, this would leave you scarred in a way that they never touch in the show, but you bring that to the movie and we respond to it because we all think in our heads, this is exactly what it would be like. This is exactly what you'd feel like. And when you get to Lessons, and Picard has the relationship with her, and he's finally kind of working through what it would be like maybe to have a relationship with somebody, you get the fact that he's actually thinking about, obviously, this experience that he had. It's just a little bit too bad that this obviously leaves him changed forever. But there's only a couple of times you see it. And I don't necessarily think it just had to show up with Picard trying to pursue a family. I think it really should have changed with the way Picard dealt with his crew. I think he should have gone to the poker game a lot sooner than All Good Things. Because I think that this experience would have had that effect on him. It might not have meant that he went and dated Beverly or somebody else. But I think it might have meant that he realized that cloistering himself as the captain and leaving himself with such reserve was actually harming him in some ways. It was leaving him not as human as he could be. And that's one of those beautiful things about All Good Things, is when he finally walks into that room, we all go, thank God, he's getting it finally.
It's about time.
Yeah, exactly. And I wish that it just had happened more.
How do you feel, Matt, about the Picard suppressing certain parts of his psyche? I mean, you've got the other TNG episode when his mind is joined to Beverly's, mm-hmm. and she finds out that he genuinely loves her,
right?
Which is another thing that he suppresses for years, his mm-hmm. love for her. So, you know, how do you feel as a character, the character of Picard, suppresses so much of his personal feelings in order to be the captain?
I think it's at a loss to himself. I was talking to James Swallow, who just wrote Stuff of Dreams, where Picard has to go back through the Nexus. And we were talking about this idea of Picard, and that really we both feel like Picard's just kind of a very stuffy and stoic character in the show. And it's only by finally allowing him through the novels to have a family that he's actually become human in some ways, like more human. And he's actually become, I think, a better captain because he's allowed himself to experience this. He feels greater, like the sense of urgency of protecting his crew and the Federation all has grown because he now knows what it's like to feel that feeling towards his family. And it's only made him better, I think, in the end. And that's really what I would have hoped for the show, and where I'm very thankful again for novels where they can explore this more. And now they have the freedom because it's the only place where the Prime Universe exists and they can pretty much do whatever they'd like with the characters. But, you know, again, this is TNG at its best, and I don't want anybody to think I'm slamming this episode because it's my favorite TNG episode. And
no, we're just talking about...
No, I don't think that. I think it's interesting and all that. Like, Chris has put the links on the Trek FM website to the outer light.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually... I had a talk with Morgan Gendel last year about the inner light. You can actually hear it if you haven't heard it yet. It's on Matterstream. I forget which episode of Matterstream, but if you go to the website, go to iTunes, and look up Trek FM Matter Stream. You'll find it. And I believe it's called The Inner and Outer Lights, something like that. But we talked about how he came to write this episode and then what he's trying to achieve through The Outer Light, which is a graphic novel sequel that he wrote. Now, I think we're just talking here about, you know, how this impacts Picard. And, you know, I think if The Next Generation had been created a decade later, we probably would have seen on the screen a lot of the things that we're talking about here. At the time The Next Generation was conceived, this approach was the norm on television, and that started changing in the 90s, mid-late 90s into 2000s. So the show is a product of its time. You know, I'm often hard on Voyager because of this type of approach to storytelling, and people probably think that I'm biased because I give TNG a pass where I'm tough on Voyager, but it's because Voyager was being produced at a time when serialized storytelling was becoming the norm. But TNG was produced at a time you know, this is the approach that you would take. So
I've got to defend my show, man.
But that's the reason why I'm a little bit tougher on the lack of consequences from episode to episode when I talk about Voyager compared to The Next Generation.
The fundamental difference between TNG and Voyager is tea and coffee.
Well, that's right. And coffee wins. Sorry, no doubt about that.
Yeah.
No, I think Voyager gets a lot of flack because it was sort of in this weird transitional period. It started in the mid-90s where you had some, but very few shows doing the more, arc format. But episodic storytelling was still, I would say, more the majority than not. I mean, they were just...
That's true.
They would have been a little too early on the curve, I think.
Maybe,
lest we forget,
but it was...
Deep Space Nine was one of the very first to really get this going.
That's right. But that's the thing with Star Trek, is that it was being written in the same building on the next floor up.
Yeah.
And the same time that was going on, so...
The Voyager writers also had to answer to UPN.
Well, this is true.
Deep Space Nine did not.
That's a big problem. That was a big problem for Star Trek. It was for Enterprise as well.
Yeah. I the more I learn, the more I blame those guys at UPN
for
a lot of Voyager's problems.
Most definitely. Yeah.
But anyway.
They're what, tea drinkers?
Yeah. One of the things that is my favorite part of this episode, just to kind of get back to the episode, is actually the music. And, of course, the theme from The Inner Light is probably the most beautiful Star Trek music that's ever been written, I think. And Jay Chataway just did a fantastic job of creating a theme that really resonates with you. And when you hear the full orchestration of it on any of the CDs that it's been released on, it really just takes you away. And it really captures the emotion and the beauty and the wonder of this episode and what Picard has been going through as a character. And it has that haunting beauty to it, because we all know that this civilization isn't going to last. And so that's one of those things, I think, too, that makes this episode stand apart from others, is just they actually created a theme for it and allowed that to resonate within the episode. And it's something that, you know, you just want to listen to over and over again. So it's one of those, you know, lightning in a bottle episodes where everything just worked to perfection to create something that will last as long as, you know, Star Trek fans are watching Star Trek.
Right.
Yeah. And the best version is with the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Just saying.
Yeah, it is beautiful. I know this is a fan favorite, and I think it's one of the best episodes of television, you know, of any show that has been written, except maybe Bosom Buddies, but otherwise, you know.
Well, who can top that?
Well, Alf, yeah, right? So, I mean...
Maybe Alf, yeah. But I do know some fans who don't like this episode, and what elements of this episode do you think, let's just think as average Star Trek fan here, what elements do you think might pull people out of this episode?
an average Star Trek fan. I think I can come down that to that level.
What I mean by that is
the
general audience, because people look for very different things in Star Trek. So if we take the Star Trek audience as a whole.
I know some people didn't like the jumping back to the ship bit.
They wanted to stay on Katana.
Yeah, they wanted to stay on the planet, yeah.
You know,
I think
the coming back to the ship bit was necessary.
Yes, me too. And I thought they tied them together pretty seamlessly myself.
Yeah. I think they handled that very well. That they went back to the ship just long enough to establish the fact that this was all taking place in Picard's head. And that the time frame for the crew was very compressed. But they quickly got out of that and they went back to the planet.
Yeah.
Which I thought was handled really well.
That's why I think it was necessary.
Yeah. It's not like a lot of Voyager episodes where they have something like this going on and they keep going back to the ship for something that's completely unrelated to the story.
They're looking for the reason.
Yes. Yeah, there's purpose to this very much.
So here it was necessary.
Yeah.
Yeah, here they needed to do it and they did it quickly and they got back out. So you spend most of your time with Kamen on Katine.
Well, and this episode just goes to prove that Beverly was the smartest person on the bridge in this episode, because she's the only one saying, let's just wait this out. We have no idea what this is doing to the captain, and everybody else is trying to act, and it ends up almost killing
it's
him.
True.
And so I love that
Worf wants to fire phasers at
Worf is trying to destroy
Worf,
it.
The captain is being attacked. Suggest we do the same.
Yeah, and Riker has to shoot him down because Picard's incapacitated.
Yeah, it's
no, Worf, we're not going to do that.
It's just crazy, but you know,
it's very crazy because it's one of the few moments when Beverly actually wants to keep a patient alive.
Exactly. And so I love Beverly in this episode.
You love Beverly in every episode, Matthew. What are you talking about?
Okay, that's true.
Well, she was having a good hair day in this
episode.
Yeah,
she really was. It's fantastic.
She was, yeah.
Yeah, she'd just come from the hairdressers by the look of it.
Yeah. Mott had really done a good job.
And curled.
I like how she says, we have no idea what's going on, when she really means, I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
But she tries to push it off on the whole bridge crew.
She's offsetting the blame.
She's like, everyone, just look at the flashy blinky lights. Everything will be okay.
And she did have an awful lot of toys.
She did, didn't she?
She did. She brought out all sorts of weird little medical devices.
Yeah.
In the Blu-ray version of this, where you really can see the detail of all that equipment, those lights are going wild. There are so many lights, and they are just flashing all over the place.
It's disco on the bridge.
It's a disco on the bridge.
They had dance breaks in between. Yeah. When they cut back to Kamen, everybody just got up and...
That's why Worf's hair was messed up. He was breaking out on the top.
Hey, that makes so much sense. Yeah. I'm sure the monkey joined him on the bridge for a moment.
Yeah.
He's swinging
with the monkey
across the bridge.
Yeah. Data would fling him around.
The reason that
That's
Troy
what
wasn't
happened to
there.
Picard. He slipped on a banana peel, fell down, hit his head.
Concussion. Yeah.
They thought it was a probe. Actually, it wasn't.
The reason Troy wasn't there is she had had too much to drink already, and she had to go back and sleep it off. And that's why she's actually just asleep through this whole episode.
And
now it makes
Wesley's
so much
not
more
there because he's on a date with Loeffler.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, of course.
Who knows what they're doing in the Jeffries tubes?
Well, and Argyle's there.
That's
He's
true.
He's probably got the camera on watching.
Yeah. Oh, God. You think Argyle's a creeper? He has like little holes drilled in the Jeffries tubes all over the ship.
Come on. Of course Argyle's a creeper. Duh.
Yeah, but he's holed up in the Jeffries tube with a barrel of gin. He's got nothing else to do, so.
Exactly. Of course he's a creeper.
Speaking of creepers, again, I've never noticed this until last night when I watched this again. And again, maybe it's the HD where I can really see Riker much more clearly. But at the end of the episode, when Riker comes to Picard's quarters and he brings him the flute, the way he walks in, the look on his face, how he gets so close to Picard, it was really creepy. I was like, back off, Will, back off.
Well, he was getting ready to put his leg up on a chair and then stuff his crotch in Picard's face.
Probably.
But did you notice that shot when Picard is lying down on the deck? Riker is in the kneeling position, so his crotch is
yes, I did notice.
What is it with Riker in that? I don't know. But
dude's got issues.
Frakes comes in the same way. If you watch many 80s sitcoms, and Alf is a great example, hell, when someone is going to enter a room or enter a house, they open the door, they always walk in really quickly and start talking, and they get really, really close to the person they're talking to. And it seems to just, I don't know, it's always jarring to me. And that's what Riker does at the end of this episode, and I never really picked up on it before, but it just caught me. I was like, really, back off, man.
Chris,
it's like having a Jehovah's Witness bring you a gift.
Go back to Deanna, please.
Yeah. Chris, I'm with you, because he just walks in and he has this kind of weird smile on his face.
Right,
and
the smile, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing that I found that was so weird.
He's like, just a weird scene. You've been shacking up with some woman on this planet for 42 years.
Hey, so how was it?
You dog.
Exactly. Hey, here's a question for you guys. Had it not been Picard who was probed, who would you have wanted to have been picked for this new alternative life, and what would have happened? Because my vote was for Riker. And instead of 5 years, I would have given him maybe 5 days before the kids started
joking.
Coming along.
Riker on his own in a village, and he's... No, Riker would have...
He would father so many children. I mean, he'd be divorced pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But he would be the father to many children with many women.
Yeah, the civilization would not have died out because there would have been billions of them.
Or would they have died out faster because of lack of resources? He'd kill his own people. But he'd die trying to preserve.
Imagine if Worf had been the one down there. Worf would have wanted to hunt down the cause of the climate change, destroy it.
Yeah, Worf would have declared war on the sun.
So just rebuild a missile and launch it at the sun, sir. No, we're not going to do that.
No.
He would even get shot down by the administrator.
Yes, he would. You and your ideas.
No, but then he would have said to the administrator, if you were any other man, I would kill you where you stand.
Yeah. And that's where the Andorian fight scene would come in.
Exactly. That's why we don't see the administrator until the end of the episode again. After he leaves... When he gets right on the outskirts of the town, that's when the Andorian jumps out and kicks his ass.
Right.
How do you give up? Never! Choice.
They got to keep the Andorians at bay.
That's where Shram's hiding, waiting for them. Then,
yeah, who knew?
You know,
I'm glad we've got this all figured out now.
Sure, I don't know if I could think of anybody else that I would have wanted this story to be about. I was thinking through.
I'm not saying profound.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking about the characters and. I don't know if I could think of one that I feel like it would just work as well, or I don't know.
It wouldn't have worked with Leffler because she'd have come up with too many roles.
Yeah, exactly.
You can only water your lawn on Tuesday and Thursday.
You know what? Leffler would have become the administrator.
She would have.
That's true.
That's what Leffler would have done.
There would have been a whole book full of Leffler's laws for coping with climate change.
And everybody would hate her. Except for you, Chris.
Oh, goodness. And then she would have run for Senate. Yeah. She would have said she was going to run for Senate, but then not. It would have been a mess.
She would have been on the council. Then I'm not going to be on the council.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
See, and he wouldn't have worked with Geordi because there's no way Geordi would have stayed with a woman for 5 years.
He wouldn't have gotten any ever. Yeah, no woman would have stuck around long enough.
Well, we've been talking for close to an hour on the Inner Light, and I think we've run through it is a Picard story. It's all about Picard and what's going on inside his mind. I think we see a lot of that play out here. and how we deal with change, and you know, how we deal with the moment, how we come to accept change, and what we, you know, try to leave behind for our children as well. So why don't we wrap up with final thoughts? Colin, first, do you have any final thoughts on the Inner Light?
Yeah, well, I particularly like the way that Picard, through the aging process, became to look like Data's dad.
He actually kind of did, didn't he? Yeah.
So I presume they just reused the prosthetic makeup and twisted the nose a bit. But it's also interesting in the fact that life imitated art in this particular scene, because Daniel Stewart, Patrick Stewart, didn't want him to be an actor. And you have that scene where he's telling the son, think about what you want to do. You want to do this, you want to do this, you want to do this. But overall, to me, it's the powerful performances in this particular episode. Patrick Stewart is definitely on his A game. But the rest of the cast is strong as well, because if Patrick Stewart's on his A game, you've got to be in your A game.
That's what I was thinking as I was watching, that when they cast the guest actors for an episode like this to play opposite Stewart, they really, really have to cast well, because otherwise the whole story would fall apart if they couldn't hold their own.
And they so did.
Patrick Stewart.
Yeah. They found such an incredible... They nailed it.
Yeah. The ensemble cast was phenomenal cast. You know, I mean, even the kids could act, and that's rare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I like it. It's a powerful. It's Star Trek doing what Star Trek does. It's reflecting what we now know as global warming, which is probably one of the worst known things ever. But still, climate change, and it's also reflecting a life that could have been had Picard taken a different path, and to me the message that it's giving on two levels, and the strong acting from everyone involved, just knocks this one out of the park for me.
So what's your rating for this one, Colin?
I would give this 9 penny whistles.
Excellent.
Very good.
Shar, how about you? Final thoughts?
Final thoughts? Well, I mean, yeah, what more do you say about this kind of an episode that really is as close to perfection as you can possibly get? We've already mentioned how everything is so incredibly well done in this episode. Everything comes together, from the look of it, the guest actors, Patrick Stewart's performance. The story is incredibly strong. It has some very profound messages in it. It's got the commentary on climate change. We have Picard learning to seize the moment as he embraces a life that he has chosen not to have up until that point. And I feel like it opens a lot of doors for him. It's incredibly profound what this 45 minutes of TV can do in the short amount of time that it gives itself. Pretty incredible. There is a good reason why this one stands out above the pack. And Chris, I think capstone it, this is not just a Star Trek episode. This is excellent sci-fi. Period. And I have a massive appreciation for that. So I give this one 10 soil samples.
Good. How about you, Matthew?
Well, this is, as I said, my favorite TNG episode. And I really like this episode because of what it has to say about the important things in life. And this episode reminds us what's really important. And I just love that Star Trek, and especially TNG, went there in this episode with Picard and finally really opened up his character. I mean, he'd been through so much in the Borg. We got a great inner look into him and family, and then there's this episode finally to really open him up again as a character. And this proves, too, I think, that Star Trek and these writers on TNG could really write character. They knew what they were doing. I wish that they had just given them a reins and really let them run then with character. And, you know, a lot of these same writers, and Ronald D. Moore was a producer at this point on TNG, and they let them run wild on Deep Space Nine, and look what happened. These characters are great. I love Picard as a character when they give him something to do. I love when they let us know more about somebody like Riker or even Troy, Worf, Data, Geordi, Crusher. Any of these characters are fantastic. And this episode was just the prime example of what they could do when they were given the ability to do it. And I love its message. Take hold of the moment. Take hold of this time because it's never going to come again. And live for others, because that's really the message of this episode too. Live for your family. Live for the relationships that you're in, because that's really what matters. That's really what's eternal in some ways. And I really enjoy this. So honestly, I couldn't give this episode a higher rating. I'd give it 10 out of 10 mind probes.
Good. Yeah. Well, I think you guys have pretty much said it all. This is one of my favorite TNG episodes as well. One of my favorite Star Trek episodes in general, probably one of my favorite episodes of any TV series. And I love the exploration of, you know, what is at the core of a person. And we see how Picard, even as he loses his identity, as becomes Kamen, that the core person is still the same in both cases. And we get to see that journey through life, especially with the children. And you see how he has to, as his children grow older, he has to come to terms with the fact that they have their own ideas and they see their own paths. And you see that how he deals with his son and his son's interest in music. And that's something that he fostered in his son in the first place. But maybe because of life, he knows that that might not be the best path for him to follow, you know, in terms of his overall life and security and such, but it's what makes him happy, and learning to let go of that and accept change in life. And that runs through all of this as well. We didn't really talk much about the relationship between Kamen and Aline, you know, on a personal level, but it's very compressed, but I think it's a very beautiful journey that they have as a couple, especially at the end, which always gets me at the end where she's passing away. And so just there's so much character in this episode, and really good writing by Morgan Gendel. And I'm going to give this episode 10 probe pendants.
Nice.
All right. Well, we have a whole Trek FM crew here, but nevertheless, before we go, let's tell everyone where they can find you. So, Matthew, where can we find you on the internets?
Well, if you're just perusing the interwebs and looking for me, you can find me at MattRushing02 on Twitter. And then, of course, you can find me on Trek FM doing the book reviews as well as Literary Treks, where we talk books and comics with my esteemed colleague Christopher Jones, as well as The Orb, where we talk all things Deep Space Nine, again, with my illustrious friend Christopher Jones.
You are everywhere.
Illustrious and esteemed.
Yes, Christopher Jones is everywhere. He's a lot like Jeffrey Combs.
A little bit crazy. So
that's true. All we right. weren't going to mention that, but
we love you for it.
How about you, Shar?
Well, of course, you can find me all over Trek FM. I'm managing people. I'm not. I'm editing their work though, and I occasionally write things still, but mostly I'm editing these days. And then, of course, you can find me with my lovely and talented co-hosts Lori and Tristan for To the Journey.
To the journey!
Little slow, guys, but you were in sync this time. That's good. We'll keep working on it. And then, of course, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is Oh the Profanity.
Well, Chris, that was great to have Matt and Charlene on discussing all things Inner Light. And I think they made some very good points. Matt got into the alternate psyche of Picard, and Charlene got into the monkey.
Of course. I think I may have been the one who instigated the whole monkey bit, but Char's always happy to play along with the monkey.
Oh, yes. Char's more than happy to play with the monkey.
She likes to play with the monkey, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a good discussion, and I'm glad we kind of dig into Picard a bit more, because it is one of the great character tales of Picard, even though it doesn't take place on the ship or in the Star Trek wrappings that we're accustomed to. So very excellent. Yeah,
but still made excellent science fiction.
It really did, definitely. Well, Colin, let's tell everyone where to find us if they'd like to share their thoughts on The Inner Light or anything we talked about in news today. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form, and you can choose to send to a show, send to the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. You can also go to our forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section for the Ready Room. There's one for The Next Generation if you would like to talk about this episode or anything else related to TNG. You can do that there. And of course, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username trekfm. Colin, what if people would like to find you personally?
Well, you can find my personal account on Twitter at colmh01, which is also exactly the same on Google+. Or you can find me on the Trek News and Views podcast or Deck 8 podcast, which are both on the Trek FM network.
Excellent. You're kind of everywhere too. We're
yeah, everywhere. Yeah, I'm a bit like Jeffrey Combs.
All right. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that username. And you can find me elsewhere on the network, as Matthew mentioned, at the end of the feature with him on Literary Treks to talk books and comics, and on The Orb, where we talk all Deep Space Nine all the time. You can also find me from time to time on my interview show, Matterstream, where I talk to writers and scientists and others about things just barely loosely related to Star Trek most of the time. Had a lot of great guests on there. Rod Roddenberry's been on there twice, in fact, so a good place to learn more about how Star Trek affects the world as a whole, and that's at trek.fm/ms for Matterstream. And we'd also like to invite you to support our sponsor, Squarespace. It's the fastest, easiest way to create a blog, a website, or an online store. Share your photographs, your artwork, and your portfolio. You'll absolutely love it. Go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK4 to get 10% off your lifetime purchase on your accounts. That's squarespace.com/trek and offer code TREK4. Well, Colin, we've had a lot of talking here. I need a break. I'm going to wander off through the ship, see if I can find out what Troy's actually been up to all this time.
Well, Chris, I think it's time to put a Resican flute in it, because the Ready Room is done.
By the way, safe word, guys?
Probe.
Best safe word ever. Wow, look at you, Mr. Rushing. I'm impressed.